Since the dawn of recorded history, mankind has been obsessed with his bollocks. Welcome to Jim's Bag of Bollocks, the show which expands your mind and your asshole. This week I'll be reviewing Die Hard 4.0, the strategy RPG Overlord, Escape Pod, and much more. But first...
I am a robot. Tech news.
If you're even remotely interested in breathing, you'll have heard that Manhunt 2, Rockstar's ultra-violent sequel to the infamous Manhunt, has been banned in the UK by the BBFC. Now, I personally have no interest in playing said game, and I own neither of the systems it was coded for, but I feel incredibly annoyed that as an adult, I'm now unable to purchase the game even if I wanted to. The game was refused a rating for, quote, unremitting bleakness and callousness of tone in an overall game context which constantly encourages visceral killing with exceptionally little alleviation or distancing. Sounds like a video game version of Saw or Hostel to me. If you're wondering why the BBFC lets through plenty of movies which are arguably just as sadistic and equally as violent, it's because they treat video games differently as there's an element of interactivity involved. The BBFC themselves alluded to this in a recent IGN article, quote, if that had been a film, it would be okay in a linear format, but with the element of interactivity in games, with the ability to do it over and over again, we might bump the rating up to a higher category. That seems like a reasonable distinction, but hold that thought. It's a little at odds with a later statement in the same article. We're not singling out games. But you do treat them differently to other forms of media, right? That's what you just said. We all know that one major underlying reason for banning the game is to prevent impressionable people from performing acts depicted in the game in real life. In short, there's a worry that Manhunt 2 could turn someone into a violent killer, so banning the game can, in theory, prevent a future murder. It's Minority Report time, kids. That's debatable. In fact, it's an absurd idea which proponents of video game censorship latch onto. Millions upon millions of people play violent video games for hours on end, and the vast overwhelming majority of them have never killed anyone. The kind of person who ends the life of another after playing their PlayStation was probably in a dangerous state of mind to begin with. The BBFC themselves recently published research which would appear to contradict their own stance. From the same IGN article, one of the things we found, which we weren't really expecting, was that people felt the interactivity slightly distanced them from the game. What with having to press buttons, you are more likely to be aware that you're playing a game. And from the published research paper, a number of points may be made that, taken together, make the incidence of violence in games more comprehensible and perhaps less malign than they initially appear. In other words, if you pull your head out your ass and look at the facts, you'll see that video games aren't the evil tools of Satan they're made out to be by lobby groups. First, violence, in the sense of eliminating obstacles, is built into the structure of many games and it would be impossible to progress without it. Most gamers see eliminating enemies as another step in the game rather than something to savour for itself. Secondly, violence contributes mightily to the tension in games, not least because gamers are not just shooting, they're also vulnerable to being shot. Most gamers concentrate on their own survival rather than on the damage they inflict on others. Third, the opportunity to be violent without being vulnerable to consequences clearly underscores the appeal of some games as escapist. The violence helps make the play exhilaratingly out of reach of ordinary life. Fourth, gamers seem not to lose awareness that they are playing a game and do not mistake the game for real life. Let's hear that last part again. And do not mistake the game for real life. With a touch of reverb?
They do not mistake the game for real life.
Well, that's the point, really, isn't it? It's frankly insulting that as gamers we don't seem to be trusted to make the distinction between polygonal gunfights and the humdrum of everyday life. I've spent far more time playing Grand Theft Auto than I have driving an actual car, but while doing the latter, I've never felt the need to do 150 miles per hour on the wrong side of the road, ram adjacent vehicles out of my way, or do a little carjacking every time I see someone driving a cooler vehicle than the one I'm currently trashing. As if the BBFC ignoring their own research was bad enough, ELSPA, the Entertainment and Leisure Software Publishers Association, have praised the ban. You'd think they'd be fighting Rockstar's corner, but no. From their website.
A decision from the BBFC such as this demonstrates that we have a games writing system in the UK that is effective.
Bollocks! If anything, the decision demonstrates the exact opposite. The BBFC themselves operate under the assumption that even 18-rated games are often bought and played by minors. If the rating system was effective, then they could have just slapped an 18 rating on the product and called it a day, safe in the knowledge that anyone too young and impressionable to play it would have a hard time obtaining a copy. The reason they can't make that assumption, of course, is largely down to idiotic parents who bizarrely take very little interest in the media their children consume until there's a politically correct bandwagon to jump on. Yes, I'm blaming the parents. One only needs to look at the controversy surrounding the original game to see why. Way back in 2004, Stefan Pekira, a 14-year-old schoolboy from Leicester, was murdered by his best friend Warren LeBlanc. The victim's mother maintained that the video game Manhunt was responsible. Her MP Keith Vaz agreed with her, and so did a lot of Britain's news media. The police and the courts didn't. The police denied any link between the game and the murder and cited drug-related robbery as the official cause. The judge presiding over the case placed the blame solely on LeBlanc himself. It also emerged later that the killer didn't even own a copy of the 18 certificate game in question, while the 14-year-old victim did. If you ask me, the ban of Manhunt 2 panders to this mindset, this ridiculous idea that a violent computer game, a piece of entertainment enjoyed by millions of well-adjusted individuals all over the world, can somehow be responsible for a murder. What it boils down to is this: responsible adult gamers are being treated like children because of irresponsible parents who are incapable of vetting the media their own children consume. I mean, admittedly, the game is probably shit, but banning it is a terrible thing to do. Is GTA 4 now at the mercy of the same mindset? Unfortunately, yes. Let's hope common sense prevails in future. Overlord is a strategy RPG from developers Triumph Studios in which the player is put in charge of an army of minions and given a world to go forth and be really, really, really evil in.
Your throne room, sire. Alas, one cannot be a bastion of evil these days without wretched heroes lining up to prove themselves. That last lot were particularly bothersome. They also looted and destroyed much of the tower. Punish those so-called heroes and re-establish a dark domain. You are our new overlord!
It plays like a cross between Dungeon Keeper and Fable. It contains a lot of elements from the former and looks and feels like the latter. Whereas with most modern RPGs, the player is usually faced with a choice between doing good deeds or bad ones in order to progress the storyline in a particular way, the choices in Overlord tend to be between evil or more evil. The whole point of the game is to be a bastard, and it's damn fun, and very addictive. In fact, it's probably the most addictive game I've played for a very long time. Here's how it works. Take a typical third-person RPG. Now add an army of demonic gremlin-type things that follow you around and pander to your every whim. You control your army by literally pointing at objectives. Once there, the minions will use context-sensitive AI to determine what you want them to do. For example, if you send them toward an enemy, they'll attack. If you send them towards a huge pot of gold, they'll pick it up and carry it back to your tower. It sounds rather simple, and it is, but it's a joy to play. There are four different kinds of minions with different strengths and abilities. The in-game obstacles require you to assign appropriate minions to different tasks, something which can be difficult, but only because the oversimplified control scheme can sometimes be a hindrance. The puzzles you'll come across are never very difficult to solve, provided you have the correct kinds of minions available, and not all of them are at the start of the game. It's not a perfect game by any means. As I've mentioned, the control scheme can sometimes be a little too simple for its own good. It's also quite shallow, both in terms of the game world and the storyline. I just don't feel immersed in Overlord in the same way I do in, say, Fable or Oblivion. Everywhere I go just feels like a playground, a model village which I've been allowed to stamp on. That's not really a bad thing, and I suppose that's the whole point. The underlying premise of the game is to let you have fun smashing things up. And what good fun it is. One of the best elements of this game is the humour. It's rare for a computer game to contain one laugh-out-loud moment, let alone be stuffed full of them. If you enjoy RPGs or third-person puzzlers, or even if you fancy playing a quirky, original game for a change, then you can't really go wrong with Overlord. It's out now for Xbox 360 and PC.
Tellywank.
Were it not part of its parent franchise, and if it starred Vin Diesel instead of Bruce Willis, Die Hard 4.0 would probably be dismissed as an overblown, ridiculously far-fetched popcorn flick and filed in the same bargain bin as Triple X, Crank and The Transporter. Admittedly, and I'm not comfortable saying this, the fact that it is a Die Hard film alters my perception to such a degree that this review will be overwhelmingly positive.
Did you want to say something?
Yippee-ki-yay.
Why'd you bring a cop into my command center?
Command center?
It's a basement.
Who is this man?
After all, what's not to love about seeing balding, wisecracking New York cop John McClane beating the shit out of bad guys for one last time? Old Brucey slips back into his defining role, and although he seems a little uncomfortable at the start, by the end of the first act you wouldn't know it had been over a decade since he'd last filled those shoes. The action sequences are superb, and Die Hard 4 is stuffed to the gills with them. It feels like there are enough balls-to-the-wall, white-knuckle moments in this flick to fill a whole new trilogy, but it never feels too overbearing or unrelenting. Surprisingly, the script completely avoids being bogged down with dialogue references to the earlier films and concentrates solely on its own story, which is no bad thing. The plot centres around John McClane thwarting a cyber-terrorist group whose motives don't become clear until around the middle of the film. The villains hack into major government computer networks and systematically plunge the country into chaos. For example, they compromise a traffic control system and set all the traffic lights in the country to green. This causes numerous car crashes and pileups, and brings the entire city of Washington to a standstill. My suspension of disbelief became in danger of faltering as I was reminded of Superman 3. Its depiction of computer hacking and information technology in general was typical of Hollywood, often implausible, sometimes ridiculous. The story moves along fairly quickly, and there aren't really any huge and obvious plot holes, which is something of a minor miracle in itself, but there's a lot of downright silliness going on. The amount of damage some of the characters walk away from is phenomenal even for Die Hard, and there's a particular scene with an F-15 fighter jet which breaks new ground in Hollywood absurdities. Well, I don't want to spoil it, but to be honest, the less said about it, the better. Also, the writers seem to be under the impression that cellular phones rely on satellites to work. Unless I'm very much mistaken, GSM networks rely on mobile phone masts, and they are very much earthbound. Perhaps I'm nitpicking, but oversights like this irritate me and take me out of the story, even if it's only for the briefest of moments. It's still annoying. The film is also slightly emasculated by the noticeable lack of bad language. I know this was necessary to achieve a 12A rating, but come on, a Die Hard should be a 15 at least. You can tell exactly where they had swearing in the script, because the film is peppered with examples of bad overdubbing. Word is that there will be a full uncut Region 1 DVD release with all the sweary bits intact, and even extra blood. Here's hoping. I'd say Die Hard 4.0 is much closer in feel to Die Hard with a Vengeance than it is to the first two. It's certainly a worthy addition to the saga, but I do hope they stop here. This installment was very much in danger of becoming a parody of itself. The first film saw a building in jeopardy, the second an airport, the third an entire city. This one put a whole country in peril. If they do a fifth, what will be at stake? The entire planet? The whole galaxy? Basically, it's surprisingly good. It surpassed all my expectations, and I didn't feel cheated out of my £5. I mean, what more can you ask from a wheezing 80s action franchise?
It's been a really shit week for Telly, even shitter than an holiday in Delhi. Why did I bother watching Telly? Instead I could have made some jelly.
Why oh why did I bother giving Hyperdrive another chance? I gave up after 3 episodes last year because it is quite possibly the most tedious and unfunny sitcom I have ever seen. Unfortunately, it hasn't improved. The characters are uniformly unlikable. Even Commander Henderson, despite being portrayed by Nick Frost, who is usually so cuddly and lovable even when he's playing incompetent dickheads, which he always is. In Hyperdrive, he's just a phenomenally irritating fat shit with no redeeming qualities whatsoever. This isn't the fault of the actor, it's purely down to the writing and direction. Even typically great performances from Kevin Eldon and Miranda Hart can't save this piece of shit show from comedic oblivion. It's sad to see such a good cast going to waste on such poor material. It's supposed to be a comedy, but punchlines are thin on the ground. It's so devoid of humour that you'd think David Cameron's speechwriter was involved. In fact, there are probably more jokes in Mein Kampf, and every half-decent joke it does come up with is overdone and milked to hell. The CGI is, frankly, awful. Red Dwarf looked better than this on a fifth of the budget, and that was nearly 20 years ago. Speaking of which, I'm sorry, but no whinge about Hyperdrive would be complete without the obligatory Red Dwarf comparison. Admittedly, the shows are very different, but they're both character-driven situation comedies with a science fiction backdrop. Red Dwarf was clever, unpredictable, and witty. Hyperdrive thinks it's all those things, but it's sorely mistaken. The bulk of Red Dwarf's humour comes from its sharp script, full of scathing one-liners and brilliant verbal sparring between its characters. Hyperdrive, in contrast, prefers to simply point to the ridiculous parodical world it's set in and wait for the guffaws. Its humour is usually along the lines of laughing at aliens with stupid-looking heads or showing us an absurdity of their future society that we can all relate to. There's no punchline, there's no wit, there's no actual joke. The only moment in last week's episode that came within a light year of being remotely amusing was this.
I lost my agnosticism.
Oh, but Jeremy, if you don't have the belief that there may or may not be a god, what do you have?
But it was utterly ruined when they milked the joke to death with a cringe-worthy, horrific moment of unfunny bastardry, agnostic hymns.
Help me find it again, Chloe. Sing for me. Sing one of those old agnostic hymns.
Oh, I couldn't. I have a vague feeling inside of me, a hazy spirituality. It fills me halfway, but not to the top. Empirical reasoning makes it stop, but not quite.
Not content with utterly destroying their one half-decent gag, 2 minutes later they trot out more ambiguously worded fake him skull fuckery.
Run to the streets, tell everyone he might have made the trees, he may have made the sun. Oh, thank you if you're there, if you're not, we shan't disperse.
Please, please stop before I cough out my own spleen. My biggest gripe about Hyperdrive is that it represents so much wasted potential. The concept is sound, the situation has a lot of room for hilarity, and as I've mentioned, the cast is top-notch. But frankly, the writing is abysmal, and it lets the whole thing down. I have no idea why the BBC would have given this piece of crap show a second series, but I've got a pretty good idea. Two words, hot fuzz. Oh, and did I mention it's shit?
And what be taking that, son? It's in a right bloody state.
You must be joking. Look at the state of it.
That's in a bit of a state, like.
I ain't stealing that. Look at the state of it.
You look a right state, just like it.
It's a state. It's a bloody state.
It's a bit of a state, is it no?
The state of the nation.
Unless you've spent the last 3 weeks scouring Hyperdrive DVDs for one single joke, you'll know that Tony Blair recently pissed off out of Parliament and made way for tubby Scott Stalinist Gordon Brown. I bet he's got a bloody big cock. Gordon Brown's first month in the job of Prime Minister has been something of a baptism of fire. Literally, for as soon as Comrade Brown took the reins of government, our country was hit by possibly the most ineffective and utterly incompetent terrorist attack in the history of religious fundamentalism. The country was brought to tears of sheer laughter when a Glasgow terror cell essentially ram-raided the city's airport, setting themselves on fire in the process and failing to seriously injure one single individual. If that wasn't blunder enough, they had 7 shades of shit kicked out of them by the locals, who, in all probability, were deciding unfazed by the whole thing. One local in particular, a certain John Smeaton, is now revered as a working class deity after appearing on international news, gabbering hysterically about how he
tried to get a kick in at him, get a boot, to subdue the guy.
It's lovely to see a working class hero be held above the shoulders of men for essentially being a bit of a hyperactive tit on the world news, don't get me wrong. But the fact that the public adoration of this man completely overshadowed the release of the BBC's Alan Johnston, a man truly deserving of public admiration, is utterly perplexing to me. Anyway, in the words of Shanine Blank, star of My Tight White Ass 5, Confessions of an Anal Whore, and Your Mum's a Slut, She Takes It in the Butt 3, let's get back to Brown. I, for one, welcome our new socialist overlord, and I think he'll have my vote when he eventually calls an election. If only because the alternative is the plastic-headed, po-faced, down-with-the-kids dickhead David Cameron. A man who thinks riding a bicycle to work while his briefcase is chauffeured in a Mercedes will win votes from members of Greenpeace. A man who looks like Max Headroom's retarded cousin. A man who spent his formative years being buggered up and down the halls of Eton. A man whose Wikipedia entry now reads, David William Donald Cameron is a cunt. Phew. Gordon Brown is off to a great start. He's sufficiently different from his predecessor to rekindle public trust in the Labour Party. Hey, it could happen. He isn't David Cameron, and the aforementioned terrorist blunders have given him something of a victory over hearts and minds. And now he's managed to piss off the Kremlin by chucking four Russian diplomats out of London in retaliation for their refusal to extradite a prime suspect in the Polonium 210 murder trial. Sticking it to Russia is bound to earn him some brownie points even from the most hardened right-wingers. So it looks to me like Comrade Brown would do well to call a general election sooner rather than later to capitalise on this unprecedented mass appeal. Or am I talking shit again?
Two weeks.
Jim's Fortnight of Fun. Sponsored by Seamus McFly. This week I've been watching classic Doctor Who DVDs, having polished off my entire Key to Time box set, The Five Doctors, and the contemptible piece of turd that is the 1996 Paul McGann television movie. But seeing as I devoted an entire episode to Doctor Who 2 weeks ago, I'll leave that for another time. So I'll move swiftly on to...
Blimey! The best bleeding podcast ever!
I recently discovered a fantastic podcast which, in my view, ticks all of the boxes required to be regarded as one of the best examples of the medium. Much better than this pile of bollocks. I'm talking about Escape Pod.
The invasion fleet stood on full alert. Admiral Thurlock paced the bridge of his flagship, eye stalks trembling with fury. The door dilated, and Chief Knowledgeist Grimble entered nervously.
"Is it true?" the Admiral growled. "Have the Earthlings destroyed themselves before we could get to them?"
No, sir, said Chief Grimble. "All radio emissions from the Earth did go silent, but it's not because they destroyed themselves. Quite the opposite." He held up a small rectangle of white plastic. "They've been hurling these into space in place of radio waves. It's called an iPod shuffle."
"Great gods!" said the Admiral. "Could they have advanced so quickly?"
"They have, sir. We've been analyzing the contents. We've learned that Earth's media dictatorship has fallen, replaced by a free republic of so-called podcasts. Everyone has total free expression, and all their music can be played without a license. They all gather in an alley to elect their leaders. Currently the benevolent Queen Dawn and King Drew in the capital city of Coverville."
"But how?" the Admiral demanded. "Where did they get such ideas?"
"Well, sir, you're not going to like this part. Although they're free, they all bow to a supreme overlord, Adam Curry."
"Curry has conquered another planet?" the Admiral roared. "Damn that galactic rock and roll geek. This is the bitterest pill indeed."
Yes, sir. What should we do, sir?"
"Do? Well, we can't fight them. We'll have to create a podcast of our own and corrupt their regime from within. Get me a computer, a microphone, the cheapest mixer you can find. We will show them that we, too, have audacity."
Yes, sir, said Grimble, backing away slowly. This wasn't going to go well. He wondered if there was time to jump ship. The Wiener Rebellion was still going on in the asteroid belt. Surely they had need for an evil genius.
"And prepare the Votatron!"
Escape Pod, the science fiction podcast magazine. Find us at escape.extraneous.org.
Escape Pod is a weekly science fiction anthology show hosted by Steve Ailey. Each episode features a story, typically between 20 minutes and an hour in length. And I'm not talking any old guff. Escape Pod is the first paying market in podcasting, which means they buy the audio rights for stories from legitimate sci-fi fantasy authors, paying decent rates for high-quality writing. They rely on listener donations to do this, and this model has kept them going since mid-2005, a new media success story I'm sure you'll agree. Escape Pod is truly a sci-fi magazine for the 21st century. To me, the fact that this show even exists helps legitimise what is a relatively new and largely untested medium. The style and tone of the stories vary wildly from week to week, but the quality is consistently high, making an eclectic show which rarely disappoints, if at all. It'll keep you listening and looking forward to each new episode with a kind of excitement you'd normally associate with your favourite TV show. The stories are read by Steve himself or by volunteers from the podcasting community. And again, the standards are consistently high. I've yet to hear a reading that wasn't a good sonic match for the subject matter. Usually they're straight audiobook-style affairs with a single narrator. But sometimes multiple readers are used to good effect, and they have been known to employ background music or ambient sound effects, but only where appropriate. I absolutely love this podcast, both as a listener and as a podcaster myself. If you're a science fiction or fantasy fan, I implore you to check it out. Go to www.escapepod.org for details on how to subscribe, and if you like it, do consider donating to keep this gem of a show going. This week, the prick said a bunch of crap about something or other. Just play the fucking tape. Welcome to Prick Rants Episode 4, this is The Prick. Okay people, a few weeks ago, during the cinema rant, I made a rather unfair comment in regards to a certain director. I called you Ball Prick. Now at the time, I hadn't seen any of his film, therefore I didn't really have any significant evidence. Now, I'm sad to say, I've now seen two of his films, and I can now say without exaggeration, you Ball is a fucking prick. And I have seen my fair share of shit films. I have never seen a shittier pile of shite than his films. Let's begin with House of the Dead. The first problem is in fact the house. Now, it might as well have been called Shed of the Fucking Dead. Now, in the game, I didn't play the game that often, but I do remember that the house, per se, was a fucking castle. I mean, his house kinda looked like if you farted on it, it would fucking vaporise. The next severe problem I have with this film is you bollocks. Awful style of directing. He uses actual game footage to move the story on. If I wanted to see game footage, I would in fact play the game. The overuse of bullet time. I don't know, I think this guy must have seen The Matrix and wanted to fuck every single member of the special effects team. The so-called zombies in the film as well, you know, might as well just be rejects from the Thriller video. I've seen better looking Scooby-Doo villains. Bottom line is a big pile of shite, and in fact I have now officially labelled it as the worst fucking film I have ever seen in my entire fucking life. And I've seen X-Men 3. I would rather sit through X-Men 3 than another 5 minutes of this pile of shite. Now, moving on to Alone in the Dark. Now, this is a significant improvement on the House of the Dead, but that isn't saying a lot because it's still a fucking piece of shite. I found myself unbelievably bored by the nonsensical plot. The bullet time yet again is over fucking used, and the piss poorly choreographed action sequences just make me want to fucking vomit. One of the main problems I have about this film is the focus is on these creatures that can only exist within darkness. Now, by the end of the film, Christian Slater and Tara Reid are walking down an empty kind of road in broad fucking daylight. Like they're attacked by one of these creatures, so therefore the entire plot of this film has been disregarded. And Tara Reid, fucking hell, well let's say, you know, I'm really annoyed that this woman hasn't won an Oscar. The only reason she was actually hired was for her tits. I mean, let's be perfectly honest, people. Bottom line is that you Ball is a fucking prick. That's the third time I've said it, and I stick by it, although I better watch out because you bollocks will try and find me and beat me up for this, as he seems to think that changes opinions. This has been The Prick for Prick Rants. Just for the love of God, stop having sex with fucking spackers. Well, that's it from me. We've got special outro music this week to celebrate the rise of our illustrious leader, the Right Honourable Comrade Brown. See you next time.
United forever in friendship and labor, our mighty republics will ever endure. The great Soviet Union will live through the ages, the dream of a people, their fortress secure. Long live our Soviet motherland, built by the people's mighty hand. Long live our people, united and free, strong in a friendship tried by fire. Long may our crimson flag inspire, shining in glory for all men to see.
Jim's Bag of Bollocks often contains short clips of copyrighted material strictly for review purposes. All attributions can be found on the show notes at bollocks.jamietrinca.co.uk. That's J-A-M-I-E-T-R-I-N-C-A.co.uk.